Hey listeners, it's your host, Daisha. You're about to hear my conversation with the very talented Tamara McCoy. She both performs and teaches me about Liszt's Totentanz in this episode, which she actually performed it before we talked and recorded it because, as it turns out, it's an incredibly difficult piece to play on the piano. Oh, and by the way, we are offering a free download of Tamara's performance of Totentanz on our website. That's HoustonPublicMedia.org/classroom. So you can listen to the piece and ask questions along with me. And don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review us on iTunes because, yada, 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 you know it's the right thing to do. Also, you can follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Tumblr, YouTube, SoundCloud, Snapchat. Okay, enjoy the episode. My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark secret. I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today in the Geary studio is Dr. Tamara McCoy. She teaches applied voice and piano at Alaska Pacific University. She is sweltering currently in Houston, Texas. She's also music director at the Anchorage Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. In 2015, she was awarded an Individual Artist Award from the Rasmussen Foundation of Alaska. And with the grant that she received from Rasmussen, she just did a tour of Alaska and England this spring with her duet partner, Valerie Hartzell, who is also the director, artistic director of the Classical Minds Guitar Festival. And they toured as Duo Amici. Now Tamara and Valerie are here in Houston as part of the Classical Minds Festival and Competition. Tamara, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thanks so much. Wonderful to be here.
Yeah. So on your recent tours with Valerie Hartzell, you guys have been playing as a duo, Duo Amici. But you've also been playing solo pieces, and that's what you're going to be teaching me about today. And you should tell me what it's called, because I'm afraid to try to pronounce it myself.
That's okay. It's called Totentanz.
Oh, okay. Which I almost had it right.
Yeah, you did. Which in German means Dance of Death.
Oh, wow.
But the extended title is Totentanz Paraphrase on Dies Irae, which, and Dies Irae is a chant from the Catholic funeral mass.
Yeah, it's from like the
Day
way back.
Yeah, way,
machine.
Way back.
It's like a lot of classical music is sort of built on the Dies Irae, right? It kind of, that was like a proto-classical music.
It's definitely a medieval chant.
Yeah.
But yes, a lot of classical musicians use that theme. I think the most famous example of that is in Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique.
Right. That's right, because we talked about that piece on this show, and that is where I first heard about the Dies Irae.
Yeah.
So before we get into talking about Totentanz, Totentanz.
Totentanz.
Totentanz. Tell me a little bit about Liszt, Franz Liszt. Who was he? When did he live? Where did he live? That kind of thing.
Right. Well, he lived many places, but he was born in Hungary in a town called Rating. And he was born in the very early 19th century, in 1811. And he grew up on one of the Esterházy estates. And the Esterházy family happened to be the patrons for Franz Joseph Haydn, the famous symphony and quartet composer.
Yeah.
He was basically the rock star of his era, pianistically. I mean, women threw jewelry, all their clothing, all
underwear,
kinds of things.
Yeah. Kind of thing.
Onto the stage. Yeah. They so fawned over him that they saved his cigarette and cigar butts. And it was crazy. He was... Yeah, there's plenty of pictures on Google. You can find all sorts of things, but he's definitely a ladies' man.
Yeah, which is strange to me because I've seen pictures of him, and talented though he may have been, he was not a looker.
I think that depends on the age of the picture you're looking at, like particular age at that time. I think as a young man, he was incredibly handsome. Later on in life, not so much.
So was it kind of like a Rolling Stones thing where like Mick Jagger was, he was at one time a very good looking person.
Yes, and then that's pretty much it.
Then he... Yeah. What happened to him?
Probably alcohol and nicotine sucking the collagen out of his face.
But the ladies still swoon over him.
I know.
Because he's Mick Jagger.
Right.
Yeah.
And the ladies definitely swooned for Liszt.
Wow.
He was charismatic and famous, and that kind of does things to people.
Was it because he was charismatic and the fact that he was a brilliant composer? Like, what was it that made people sort of, because I've heard of this term, Listomania.
Right.
Which apparently is not just a song by Phoenix.
No, it's also the title of a very, very racy movie that kids should never watch. But I think Listomania came about just because of the combination of all of those things.
Okay.
He was so innovative for his time.
Yeah.
First of all, he really turned this instrument, the piano, no longer the pianoforte, we just call it the piano at this point, into a one-man orchestra.
Wow.
And not many pianos could live up to his playing. I mean, he would break them left and right. He would have a person standing by often to sort of keep track of all the broken strings while he was playing, kind of hold them to the side. So it was said that the Busendorfer was the only piano that Liszt couldn't break.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. So he really was like a rock star.
Oh, yeah.
Breaking instruments.
He had louder louds than ever before, softer softs, more virtuosity than people had ever dared to use. He was just like, he had, I think if we think of it nowadays, it'd be kind of like adding distortion to rock music.
Yeah.
He had that kind of woo-woo sound, you know, that I'm sure no one before him had had. He was rivaled really only by the violinist Niccolo Paganini.
Wow. So he just went all out.
Yeah. He became so rich that he just started giving concerts for free at one point and giving his lessons for free because he didn't need the money anymore. He was so successful.
Dang.
Can you imagine?
No.
Saying, I have enough money. That's good. Thanks.
Man. So this is why you were telling me that when you earlier bled all over our Steinway.
Sorry about that.
Your hardcore, Tamara.
Yeah, thanks.
Super hardcore.
Yeah.
So let's get into the piece. Totentanz.
Yeah.
So tell me, first of all, when in Liszt's sort of career did this piece come about, and what inspired him to write it?
That's a really interesting question, because actually it spanned a great amount of his lifetime. When he actually started working on this piece, there's a documented letter in his collection of letters that mentions him first working on the Dies Irae in the early 1830s, which means he would have been in his early 20s. And he almost got kicked out of his house in the Rue de Provence because he was practicing these variations morning, noon, and night, and just would not stop. He was obsessed with them. And it kind of makes sense if you think about it, because he was, exposed to death all around him. The cholera epidemic, you know, his father had died maybe 6 years before that, and he was kind of, you know, helping support his mother. And so that was a huge part of writing about pieces, or writing pieces that were about death and the macabre.
Yeah.
But there are many revisions of this piece. The first official sketches showed up in his sketchbooks around 1839. And then the first complete version, which is very different than the version I played for you today, was completed in 1849. So 10 years later, the first published version. And then it was revised in 1853. And the final version, along with the solo transcription, came out in 1865. And actually, just recently, I discovered there are a couple different versions of this solo version. I think someone may have loved the concerto more than the transcription and kind of overlapped the two, so made their own arrangement. But there are a couple of those out there now, too. It was first premiered by his favorite and famous piano student, Hans von Bülow, who was married to his daughter, Cosima.
Oh, okay. Okay, I see.
Yeah.
So let's, I think we should hear some of the piece. Okay. And what we're going to hear is a recording of you playing. Yes?
Yeah. Well, before we do that, let me tell you a little bit about what the piece is based upon musically.
Oh, yes, please.
Because it's actually two sets of variations. Uh-huh. The first half of the piece is a much larger set of variations based on, as we were saying earlier, the Dies Irae, which goes like this. So that's how that that tune goes. And then the second sort of third of the piece, the much smaller set of variations, is based on, believe it or not, an ancient fertility dance called La Folia. And that is, it's sort of, it's just a chord progression in its original form, uh-huh. but people have made quite famous melodies out of it. So I'll play the chord progression first. So we often hear this as the string player's version of La Folia. Okay. And actually, many more musicians than string players were obsessed with that tune. Rachmaninoff wrote a whole set of variations based on La Folia. Guitarists have used it. Many people have used it. It's almost as famous, in my opinion, as Dies Irae.
What is it about Dies Irae and about La Folia that like so have stuck with people over the ages? I mean, like when I have learned a bit about them in the past, people have talked about them kind of like. Or at least Dies Irae, that it's kind of like a musical archetype, you know, and like the hero in the story, you
right.
know, like the hero in story, sorry. Like it's just sort of this very fundamental thing.
Right.
Is that...
The hero's journey, you mean?
Yeah, the hero's journey. Thank you.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. My husband's an English teacher. I'm going to reference my Eric McCoy on this recording. He talks about the hero's journey all the time. So I think that these two pieces are almost quintessential representations of good and evil, almost, you know. I mean, you have this chant that's about the day of judgment, the judgment that God's wrath is going to come and just take the planet out, right? And then you have this fertility dance about new life and you know, inherent goodness in people, I think.
Yeah.
So that could have been the parallel that Liszt was building this upon.
Interesting. The piece is was sort of inspired by some works of art. Is that correct?
Correct. Okay. It is. First, I should mention that Liszt invented several things in the Romantic period. He did not invent program music, but he coined the term. And so program music means music that's based on extra musical sources. So in this case, it means artwork, but it could mean literature, a feeling, a scene in nature, anything separate from music, sort of in our everyday life.
What is the opposite of program music?
Probably absolute music. Music for music's sake.
Music that's just sort of, that's sort of self-referential instead of referring to something outside.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay.
Something not based on an additional idea, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So program music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this piece is based upon two pieces of artwork. And the first one is by the 16th century portrait artist by the name of Hans Holbein the Younger. And he was a famous sort of biblical characterist in addition to being a portrait artist. Mm. And he made this set of wood sketches called the Totentanz. And a Totentanz in itself is usually depicted in art by a chain of skeletons that are sort of dancing their way towards the netherworld. Mm. I mean, occasionally you see live beings interspersed in between these skeletons. But in Hans Holbein's case, he gives one or two skeletons surrounding an individual character.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so each one of these sketches has one character in mind, and you can kind of see the actions of this character and how the skeleton is influencing that person before they die.
Oh.
And sort of my favorite example in the sketches, and they're all satirical, so they have a little bit of dark humor in each one of them. But my favorite example of this is one of the skeletons is so carefully escorting this very old man with a beard as long as the floor, and he's walking along with a cane in one hand, and, you know, the skeleton is sort of escorting him toward an open grave, and right in front of his toe, right before he gets to the open grave, is a rock so that he'll trip and fall directly into the open grave.
That's so messed up.
I know it is. That's the kind of humor this guy had, but, you know, you only live once, right?
Wow. So List took a shine to these pieces?
Yes, he did. And, you know, I think that may have been where he got the idea of variations, is because there are so many of these woodcuts. There's like, it depends on which, you know, book you look in or piece of literature you get them from. But there's like between, you know, 26 and 35 of them. Mm-hmm. So plenty to work from.
I see.
And then the second piece of art is a fresco from the Camposanto in Pisa, Italy. And it's called Trionfo della Morta. Buffamarco is, we think, the original artist, but it's attributed to Orcagna. Anyway, it's a scene where, you know, it's got several things going on. You know, obviously it has angels and demons fighting each other above, and then it has piles of dead people getting squished down towards hell on the bottom. And then on one side, you got all these rich people doing their thing, not knowing anything's going to happen to them, just believing they're invincible.
Right.
You know, and then on the other side, you have the religious monks in their monastery doing their scholarly work and just being in nature, milking goats, just sitting there admiring the trees, you know, that kind of thing. And then in the middle of the painting, you have this legend called The Legend of the Three Living and the Three Dead. And that's basically a memento mori, because it has these three noblemen riding horses with their hunting dogs all around them. And all of a sudden in the woods, they come across this group of three coffins. And inside each coffin, there's a corpse. Mm-hmm. And one of the corpses sits up and says, "I know you think you're special because you're rich." And of course, I'm paraphrasing here. But you're going to die too. So you better, you know, do right by humanity. Do right by God. Get yourself in order, because you're not special just because you have a high position and a lot of money.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
So List saw these pieces, and this is what inspired him to write. Well, in addition, it sounds like he was just surrounded by a lot of death.
Yes, he was.
And
the death of his children, you know, the death of his desired marriage. It was awful. The death of friendships, all kinds of death.
Yeah. So these helped him sort of focus his creative energies, these pieces of art.
I can only guess, yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, now we have to hear some of the music. Yeah. Like, okay. So where do we begin?
We can begin at the very beginning.
Awesome.
Where you hear the piano introducing our theme, our Dies Irae theme. This part, people refer to as sort of the rattling of the bones of the skeletons.
Oh.
Yeah. And you even have several examples of these skeletons playing musical instruments, sometimes keyboard orf type instruments.
Yeah.
Right? So you can really hear the imagery.
Oh, and I noticed that there's a change in the use of the pedals.
Oh, yeah. That was just my taste.
Oh,
I like
okay.
doing things twice the same way. And here's death just flying through the air, scaring everyone. The angel of death, very apparent in the fresco. She is the largest of all the angels.
Yeah. Starts like right out of the gate. It's just like boom.
I have to say it's the most metal of all piano pieces.
Yeah.
That's pretty heavy.
For sure.
Yeah, now we get the theme presented a little more sentimentally.
Oh, I hear
sort of. It's definitely, it drops down to just a forte instead of a fortissimo.
is loud. Fortissimo is
really loud.
Super loud.
Yeah, so three Fs would, fortissimo would be really, really loud. Every time you add a letter, it's a little more loud. Now this one I attributed to a sketch called The Fool, where there's this sort of village idiot walking along the countryside, and the skeleton's kind of poking fun at him, and you know. So you hear these these phrases repeated twice, and the first time it's kind of like the fool, and the second time it's death kind of mimicking him, you know, how kids do that. They start saying what you just said, or talking over, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now this next one is called, I attribute it to the sketch called The Sailor. Uh-huh. You got just the wind blowing through these sails, rocking this boat back and forth, and in the picture you get the skeleton that's pulling the boat down into the ocean by the mast. So you hear it right here. You see what I mean? It's just... weather's demolishing this boat. This is where I bled.
Cue buckets of blood.
I know, I haven't bled with the glissando since I was in my teens.
Rookie mistake.
All right. So this one's a little more intense and exciting. I chose the merchant for this one because he was hoarding his money and people were trying to get it from all sides of him.
Yeah.
And he's just sitting there with his arms around it, you know, being pulled at from all sides. And
he's like, no, but my money's going to save me.
My money, it's going to be there. I'm anchored to it.
Yeah.
That's my life. And this next one is called, I called it The Nun. Mm-hmm. So it's a picture of this nun, and she's sitting there praying at an altar, and the altar is in her bedroom. But in her bed is this very handsome minstrel that she's longing for. So she's like praying for help because she really wants this man, but she wants to be faithful to God at the same time.
Yeah.
So she has, the skeleton shows its face as this haggard old woman that's just kind of like telling her she's going to ruin her life either way.
That's just unfair.
I know. You can hear the pain, the angst and the pain. It's so beautiful. Now we're starting to segue into the most major, sort of calm, reflective part of the entire piece. It's called Day of Judgment. It's in the key of B major. And in that sketch, you have God sitting on top of the earth with his sort of arms stretched out, like, I'm here to save you kind of thing. And you have all of his children surrounding, you know, him at the base of the earth. So it's weird because in the picture you see this planet, but all the kids are kind of around it.
Yeah.
And so he's saying, if you choose me, you'll have this bliss right here.
Yeah.
And I think this one in particular is a lullaby. You can just hear the rocking. You know, it's all for the little children.
Yeah.
You know, all the little babies. It So here's the Dies Irae theme in kind of a anticipatory major sounding section.
Yeah.
But it's very deceptive because
yeah,
it's not going to stay that way.
No, of course not.
Death doesn't stay away. I called this section the monk because he's just trying to, you know, deal with this feud between the religions. He's so full of his convictions, right?
Yeah.
And this one's the Pope, because it's a fugue, first of all. And it's gonna...
What is that technique that I'm hearing on the piano?
It's just rapid repeated notes, and it's another technique that Liszt made really famous. Basically, you just play repeated notes with your fingers like this in a plucking motion, sort of towards yourself. So,
gotcha.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I called this one the child because it's so playful.
Yeah.
It's like somebody, you know, this kid's being irresponsible. And unfortunately, everyone can die, right? I called the nobleman, and you can hear why. It's just really regal, and
yeah. This
guy's full of himself,
yeah.
And he just thinks he's the greatest power, the greatest hero.
I mean, I'm convinced. He seems pretty awesome.
Yeah. This one is the executioner of death. It's basically a depiction of a guillotine with royalty on either side. They're about to lose their heads. You can hear them tumbling down right now out of the guillotine. Here they get chopped. Bam.
Head still rolling?
Yeah, pretty much. We're about to move to the astrologer, where things get kind of ethereal and heavenly because he's looking up at the planets.
Yeah.
He's going to get killed for this, religiously. You know that, right? So you can hear the mist of the clouds. Like him just imagining this science, just being interested in the science, is going to lead to his death.
Should have known better.
Have no mind of your own. And this one's called The Soldier. It's actually the cadenza, one of the cadenzas of the piece. Which means a cadenza is like a really show-offy portion of a solo piece of music.
Gotcha.
And prior to the Romantic period, it usually was composed by the performer, it's not the composer.
Okay.
But by the Romantic period, cadenzas were being written out.
I see.
With specific instructions.
Okay. And I guess initially that was born out of the Baroque period where it was pretty common to, oh my God, what is it? Improvise.
Improvise, yeah. Exactly. This is the hero. He thinks he's going to overcome death. You can hear it. The hope is there, right? He's going to win. But death is like, uh-uh.
No.
Dies Irae comes back. Sorry. Now here we start the second set of variations based on La Folia. And that story of the three living and the three dead, you're going to really hear the hunting calls right here. So you can hear the reference right there. Plus the triplets all over the place. The three dead, the three living. This one I called the cherubs because it's just little floating angels, just baby angels all over the place. They're all over the fresco. Just fat little baby angels in the trees kind of eating fruit. And this next shorter variation is the nobles sitting in the garden playing their plucked instruments. They're playing these little plucked harps. Mm-hmm. And their flutes. And I called this one the monks because they're out in nature and you kind of hear all these, you know, scampering squirrels and bunnies and, and the birds up there in the trees. It's just very pastoral, you know? And the angels and demons fighting each other. And this one, they have a picture of angels carrying away the children to heaven so they won't be sent to hell. You hear them go there?
Wow.
They kind of rise up to the sky. Of course, this is my own, you know, idea of what the music means from studying the art.
I love that sound. That's so cool.
Thanks. And here's the pile of dead. That's literally at the bottom of the fresco. There's this pile of tortured dead people. Just kind of like...
Man, this really takes you everywhere emotionally.
I know, it does.
You're like, everything's beautiful.
Oh my God.
Everything is horrible.
Yeah. Now, here, as I mentioned before, the largest angel in that fresco is, and she's a different color in everything, is this horrible, dead-looking angel of death with a scythe in her hand, and she's flying towards the earth with her scythe in the air, ready to strike, and this is just her. Dia Siri in the left hand, the wind in her hair in the right hand. Everything stops. Everyone's like, wait a minute. There might be some hope. Give it a sec. Okay, maybe death is gone. Maybe. Not likely. There she is. Her last statement of the Dies Irae theme. In fortissimo. Three Fs.
Whoa.
Okay, I hope everyone listening to the show watches Arrested Development because that was a total reference right there. Anyway, so this piece is
that
in the
piece was wild.
I know
that was, and it took him years and years and years
to fine tune it. And actually, what you heard right there is the transcription of the orchestra and the piano part blended together because it's originally a piano concerto.
Okay.
The first programmatic piano concerto ever written. So the piano part is usually a lot less of a challenge because it's only 60% there. But this is everything. You have to be and do everything.
Yeah. I noticed there were certain parts where I was like, how are you even splitting your brain into doing this one thing over here and this other over here?
Yeah. So this piece is in the key of D minor. And as Spinal Tap said in their movie, it is the saddest of all keys.
Yeah, well, it's part of a trilogy, really, a musical trilogy that I'm doing in D minor, which I always find is really the saddest of all keys, really. I don't know why, but it makes people weep instantly to play it.
That was a real thing in the Romantic period. They had whole just books referencing the moods that each key represented.
Yeah.
Even if they were the same key, like you had B flat or A sharp, B flat had a different mood, a different use than A sharp.
Well, I heard that the Catholic Church actually came out with some sort of, I'm not even sure what it was called, like a book, some kind of writing that explained the moods and sort of nuances
of different modes. That's kind of and they had sort of intervals that were allowed and intervals that weren't, for example, the tritone, that was an illegal interval, the devil's interval.
That's right.
Musicus Diabolus or something like that. I'm not sure.
That's crazy. I don't even know how to wrap this up. I mean, it was like I just feel so emotionally conflicted right now. I'm like, I'm happy, I'm sad. Well, thank you for walking me through that piece.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for having me. This was a blast.
Yeah, this was great. And I hope you have fun at the festival.
Yeah.
And I hope that you don't melt
in the heat. And I hope we remove Steve Holt from the recording.
Just stay indoors, stay in the air conditioning. Yeah. This is my advice to you.
Okay.
You'll be okay.
Thank you, Deja.
Well, Dr. Tamara McCoy, thank you so much for being on the Classical Classroom and for teaching me all about Liszt and Totentanz, not Totentanz.
That's right.
Yeah.
You're very welcome.
All right, everybody. That does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. Follow us on social media. We have Twitter, Tumblr, YouTube, Snapchat, SoundCloud, something for everyone. Make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes and to rate and review us because it helps us cheat death for one more day. Thanks today to audio producer Todd Toten Todds Holslander for making us sound nice. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing listomanic eyes. Thanks to Tamara McCoy for being here today, and to my bud and killer guitarist, Valerie Hartzell, for helping to coordinate this interview. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Tamara also used to play in a metal band, she said. So.
That is true. We will stop there. I don't want you looking up the recording.
Oh, I will. Don't worry.
Down among the dead men.
Behold, Cerebral Onslaught featuring Tamara McCoy.